Now, on September 18th, central bank workers circulated a list of about 180 individuals who were transferring hard currency out of Iran. Was there much concern to the embassy about this problem of capital flight?
We reported the list, and we reported that there was capital flight, and obviously it was a major political signal. I'm not sure that, Frank, that we highlighted that as much as we should have at the time. And there's some doubt that the figures were correct. I mean, it did look as if it had been, it was one of those usual things of the opposition greatly exaggerating what was happening. It was probably not until somewhat later that I became aware of really how much capital flight there was in that period, but it was very substantial. People were seeing the handwriting on the wall, and we probably should have paid a little more attention to it.
As a sign of loss of confidence in the Shah's ability to
That's right.
to govern.
People deserting the ship, really.
So. Okay. In October, after Khomeini was expelled from Iraq, I think he was expelled from Iraq in early October, if I'm not mistaken, there were more protests. And on the 16th, 40 days after Black Friday, there was a general strike around the country, which lasted in some ways for several months. Mm-hmm. This is the strike. What kind of impact did the strike have on daily life, say, at the embassy, or on communications with the consulates, those kinds of things?
General strike had relatively little personal impact on Americans, simply because, you know, we had our AFEX and we had our separate stores and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And most people had their own cars and not dependent upon public transportation. So the impact was, personal impact on official Americans was fairly minor. The success of the strike, however, was a further political indication, simply that, you know, we were well advanced at this point and in a major crisis. This thing kept adding on. I remember the British ambassador saying to me, he said, "My God," he said, "they're going to come." And the night before, day or two before they did it, he and Ambassador Sullivan had been up to see the Shah and came back down to exchange notes, so to speak, and decide what they would report to London or Washington. And I went over to the embassy and sat in while they chatted. As I was walking the British ambassador's car, he said, "Oh, Charlie, so I think they're going to call a general strike." He said, "The fat's really going on." I'm not to say he used the expression "fats in the fire," but it was that kind of expression. Tony had spent most of his career in the Middle East and understood the major political significance of a successful general strike. And those things do eventually come to a halt. People can't get their money out of the banks, like all of that sort of thing. They start going running short on petroleum and kerosene. And that if you can maintain a general strike, I mean, that's very difficult for a government to survive long. Now, he was right on the nose. It was the next day a call came for a general strike. But he just sort of walking down the stairs and came to that conclusion. I guess sort of out of past experiences in the Middle East.
Around that stage, did you still think that the prices would be more or less manageable, or were you having some doubts about the Shah's future? What was your assessment of things, say by this time, when the time of strike's underway?
It was clear to me that he was facing the most serious crisis of his reign. And to me, a question I have not yet concluded, but a question whether he was going to be able to survive. I give a lecture at FS at Foreign Service Institute, in which I very frankly go back on mistakes of perception and the misuse of history for younger political officers. And I think that, as say of October 16th and 20th, I personally, I'm not saying others shared my view, I personally felt that the Shah still had the opportunity to crack down and possibly to get away with it. Not in terms of defeating the opposition, but by creating a different political situation in which he might be able to adroitly negotiate the hammer, you know, the fist and a conciliation. I drew upon my recollections of the 62-63 period when he had quite successfully used the iron fist, as he said, in which, and as you know, the demonstration were put down, Khomeini was exiled, and Iran went into a period of a great prosperity and at least a surface stability. So I thought, on the basis of that experience, and certainly I was wrong, I guess, that he still had that option, and that there's a possibility that he could create a different negotiating situation. Or to sum up, by that middle half of October, I had not concluded that all was lost.
Now, around October, I'm not quite sure about the dates, one of the leading opposition figures, Mehdi Bazargan, had developed or was developing a plan for a transitional government. The idea was to replace the Shah's regime with a constitutional monarchy, or a republic, perhaps. And the means was through a regency council that the Shah would appoint. The council would appoint a prime minister, like someone like Sanjavi. And the Shah would take an extended vacation while elections were being held for new majlis. And once a new government was formed, there would be a referendum on the future of the monarchy. And under this plan, I guess Khomeini would be invited to return to Qom, and he would ensure the public policy conformed more or less on Islamic lines. He played a sort of a distant role, but an advisory role, I guess, under this plan. I guess in October, Bazargan approached John Semple with this idea of a transitional government, hoping that the U.S. would support it, because it would leave politicians with a liberal reformist bent in charge of the government. Do you remember anything about this initial approach, the Semple or discussion of the Bazargan plan in October? I know it would come up later on, but I think that was the first time he broached it with an embassy official.
I forget the exact date of it.
Yeah.
It's certainly that would have been reported, but I simply do not recall any serious discussion in the embassy about the plan. Nor I'm quite sure was there any serious discussion in Washington about the plan. And I'm not sure whether it was that meeting or another meeting, but John was not particularly sympathetic in a sense, because in effect, Bazargan really was asking us to facilitate the end of the Shah's rule, basically, or the departure of the Shah. Maybe that meeting with another LMI person sometime later, Stumble became quite irate at one point. But quite frankly, you can't expect us and not to provide the exit of the Shah. So, I don't know how much we get. One had a great respect for Bazargan in those days. I had not met him. I'd read his bio file. I forgot most of it by now, but we had a great respect for him. Mm-hmm. But you can understand that quite literally he was asking us to get into the middle and negotiate the Shah's removal. So therefore there was not, certainly at that period our policy was still very firm, particularly in Washington, it was 110% support for the Shah. So we didn't give a great analysis and say this has some great merit, etc., etc. It's just reported, and that was pretty much the end of it.
I have the impression from accounts I've read, maybe Gary Sick's book and other books, that around October or during October, Ambassador Sullivan put a fair amount of stock in the national elections that were supposed to be held for June, I think, of the following
year.
And he was trying to get agreement on ground rules for those elections. To what extent was that the case, that he was place some emphasis on these elections as trying to get ways to ensure that they proceed on an orderly basis?
Going back to the memorandum that John Stemple wrote of his meeting with Bondorf, I think the, what we were hoping very much, of course, was that the opposition and others would work together toward that election. After the election, the Shah had promised to give what the date was, and the Shah raised that issue. And I suppose it was a drowning man, if you will, grasping at straws, is that this, if people would only follow this political process, there was a chance that something would work out that we could still protect our interests there and prevent chaos in Iran. I'm not sure any of us have any great confidence that we're going to get to election time. So we, as a nation, we were thoroughly supportive in this period of the Shah and the Shah's policies. He had taken steps of liberalization through Sharif Imami, and then later letting prisoners out of jail. Just earlier in the year, he had recommended changes in the military law. And then he made a couple of speeches, one in which he said even mistakes had been made, and I guess in the next speech he said, I have made mistakes, and talked about an election the following year. So that gave to us, it gave a political opening or a political process that one could sort of latch on to, really. And obviously, under the Shah's proposal, the monarchy would remain, but a more open political system would eventuate. So our support of that would, going back to your other question, would make us not terribly excited about the Bazargan approach, which was quite a different one.
Uh-huh. I've also read that around this time in October, Ambassador Sullivan learned about the Shah's cancer. Did you hear much about this, or were there rumors floating around Tehran about the Shah's illness, the Shah's illness, or?
No one knew about the Shah's cancer. I can take a step backwards. In the summer of 78, when I was chargé, there were wild rumors around Tehran, no matter what cocktail party or reception, whatever you went to, and talked about the Shah's health. There were rumors that he had been shot in the arm, that he had some dreadful illness. It's all of it. And so one of my jobs when I went up to the Caspian was basically to look at him. And I, it was one of the first things I would report. I would, probably a separate, what I call it, a separate little telegram saying the Shah looked fine. And he did. He looked a little thinner. Cheeks were sort of sunken in a little bit, but he's tan, vigorous. And I looked carefully. He had not been shot in the arms, or he had. And so that I concluded that he was under stress, but basically in good shape. Mm-hmm. And we did not know about his cancer.
Okay. There's no really no information on that until he's already exiled, as far as
that's
that goes.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. According to one account from Washington Post, during October, Secretary Vance is getting phone calls from John J. McCloy, Nelson Rockefeller, among others, urging Vance to back repressive measures by the Shah against the opposition. Did you hear anything about this sort of pressure from various establishment types like McCloy or Nelson Rockefeller?
No.
Did the word get to the embassy about those kinds of calls? Or,
I certainly don't remember at all. I'm 99% sure that the embassy was never informed of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, according to some accounts, around this time in October, the Shah told Sullivan that he had ruled out a major crackdown, because it would mean that it would become impossible for him to pass the throne on to his son if there really was a major serious crackdown against the opposition. Did the Shah say anything like that to Sullivan?
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. Iran?
Yeah. Yeah. Starting late, I'm not sure when the discussions started. I suppose October then became much more intensive in November, what the Shah's options were. Mm-hmm. And one of them was the Iron Fist, sort of continued liberalization and moving on to the election. Mm-hmm. Certainly the other one was the armed fist, Iron Fist. I forget what the third one was. I think the third one was that he would leave the country and just go off and forget it all. And he said he certainly could not desert his people, and he could not use the iron fist, because a monarchy could not rest in the blood of its own people. And this was said many times in October and November. The Shah had thought through this. He simply decided in that period that the iron fist would not work. When he first said this, I personally didn't believe him. I later became quite convinced, obviously, as he repeated it, that he just simply wasn't going to do it. And I finally, he's not going to do it. And people in Washington, I know, Brzezinski and others, for a long, long, long time, did not believe that he concluded this. And there's a famous telegram in which Bill Sullivan went back and said, you know, the Shah has, in effect, has thought this through. This is the way he feels, this is the way it's going to be. And that would be in November. Mm-hmm. Like the thing, of course, had we known, and it's always marvelous, yes, but had we known that the Shah was as ill as he was, and that, and the fact that he was worried about possibly dying within a year or two or three, and so therefore that passing on the throne to his son was much more close than we had any idea, but we can see how his mind was working. One thing I've never known, I never will know, is whether the Shah assumed that we knew about his illness. And you played games in this, and you double think yourself, and not a hell of a lot of profit in it. But this is in retrospect, I've wondered whether he assumed that the French had told doctors, had told the French government had told us, etc.
I sure know. Now, at the end of October, former DCM Jack Nicklaus stopped in Tehran during the course of a visit to South Asia. When I talked to him a few weeks ago, he says he remembers talking with Zamuzigar, who's former prime minister, about various political alternatives and political leaders, various political alternative political leaders. And there was some discussion about Bakhtiar, Chakrabarti Bakhtiar, as a possible prime minister who could maybe first reconcile the various opposition peoples to the Shah's regime. Was there much interest in the embassy about Bakhtiar as a political figure who could perhaps work with the Shah in stabilizing the political situation around this time?
I certainly don't recall any conversation. It's very possible that Jack had an extended conversation with the ambassador at the time, but I don't recall that following Jack's departure that we sort of had a seminar to discuss this.
I was wondering if he was under instructions to talk about this issue or not.
Well, Jack was very close to Muzigar, and of course was a very, very strong supporter of Iran. Mm-hmm. And whether authorized, he would not need direct authorization simply to talk to Muzigar, to draw of him his ideas. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What might work, because quite clearly, I mean, as I said, we were in the middle of a major crisis, and so Jack was perfectly, as far as the Deputy Assistant Secretary, perfectly free to probe for ideas that might be useful to us, frankly.
Now, in early November, George Griffin of the IRNR drafted a paper for Secretary Vance, which he stated that the Shah had basically two choices at this stage. One was to stay on in Iran as a constitutional monarch, which meant allowing the moderate opposition to rise to power. The other option was to abdicate, which would trigger a military takeover. He put it in the fairly stark terms in his summary. To what extent did you see situations and those kinds of terms by, say, November?
I certainly
did.
I give George full credit. I did not see the situation in early November. And we were talking about very early November, because it was a watershed in here, my own thinking and that of other people. In such stark terms. As an aside, in my job in Freedom of Information, I have read a very substantial number of memos for the first time, and George and INR wrote to the secretary, and I would say they were far closer to what, analysis of what was going on, hard-headed, excellent analysis than probably anybody else, frankly.
Did that something get back to the embassy in time?
I don't recall ever reading any of those, but the only thing that I recall coming from Washington at that time was when Henry Pratt wrote a similar, well, it was probably November, a similar kind of memorandum to the secretary. It was a much longer memoranda, but Henry laid it out pretty clearly, too. And Henry bootlegged a copy to us. He sent it in an envelope to the ambassador. I remember the ambassador reading it, and he made the reason. He said, thank God there's somebody back in Washington who seems to have some idea what's going on here. Didn't do much good.
On November 5th, the day after students were shot at Tehran University, there was widespread rioting, the destruction of the city. This is, some people call this the day that Tehran
burned,
yes. And the next day, the Shah reimposed martial law and appoints General Azari as prime minister. What was the mood of the embassy was that sort of the watershed that you were talking about earlier? Or was it something
that else? And the next 4 or 5 days was at least a watershed in my thinking. That was a wild day, believe me. Several very large buildings adjacent to the embassy were burnt, and so cinders and ashes were falling over my house and the embassy compound, and then all the shooting. That was a bad. I guess a friend of mine was coming in, flying into Tehran, and I with a military group. He was just going along for the ride, so to speak, and I asked him to be my guest, and I'll stay with his very, very dear friend, Ambassador Bob Pugh, who was our DCM in Lebanon when the embassy was blown up, and I guess he's Ambassador of Mauritania right now. He'd been a friend in Turkey, and they were flown by helicopter from the airport. And he said it was just unbelievable, with plumes of smoke everywhere. And of course, there's no way in the world he could get to my house with the burning and the demonstrations. And he stayed in the northern part of the city with the military. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the situation had come to the boiling point on those couple of days. I was still silly enough, in retrospect, and believed that this was the last chance of the Iron Fist. And I felt that the declaration of martial law and putting General Azari in charge was very, very possibly that last effort. That's why I say here's where the divide came, and the divide came with the ambassador, because he wrote his famous telegram on November 9th. Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned to you before, I discussed this incident with so many different classes of how a DCM ambassador sometimes can operate almost like Siamese twins, and other times not so. But on November, the morning of November 9th, I mean the morning, like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and I went out and I poured myself a scotch, and I sat around and just sort of worried. And I went in the next day and I said to the ambassador, I didn't sleep much last night. He said, I didn't sleep at all. I said, this is not going to work. He said, I know it. And he threw me the yellow line paper in his handwriting, the famous telegram.
Thinking the unthinkable.
Thinking the unthinkable. I don't know what it was. I think it was the fact that, except for one night of shooting, a military regime was not a military regime. They clearly either were unprepared or unwilling or uninstructed, in fact, to crack down. And you had the shootings when the crowds at night would get out, Allah O Akbar, and the neighborhoods go in a frenzy, and you hear a lot of shooting. But this was a regime that was not going to take that last chance of cracking down severely, going out and arresting people and doing what a military regime would be expected to do. And so I finally, I guess that morning of December 8th, when the ambassador, we both concluded that finally the Shah was deadly serious. He was not going to permit the iron fist to be used. And I felt once you had given up on that last opportunity to try it, that we'd better start thinking of the future. Very likely without the Shah, but possibly if everything worked out perfectly well. But
before we get to that table, I want to ask you, were you in touch with Iranian government officials? Were you in touch with Iranian government officials at this stage? I mean, people in the foreign ministry, and were you meeting with them in early November? Do you have a sense of their outlook on the future?
As a matter of fact, I had a visitor from the United States in that period.
Uh-huh.
And we were going to take a little trip around. And so I was busy with them for a couple of days,
yeah.
and then we got them out of town the night that martial law was declared.
Uh-huh.
They've not forgotten that in those few days, I'll tell you that. And so I was not moving around very much. It was just my sort of instinct.
Mm-hmm.
As I looked around, within those days between the 5th and the 9th, I was at a function, small function, at which I met with a number of the commanders of the services,
uh-huh.
and chatted with them about what they were doing. And as part of that kind of thing, that made me conclude that what I thought was happening was not what was happening, and that there was just a change of faces. It was not good tag. Looking back, their tag probably wouldn't have worked at that point, but whether it would have ever worked, I don't know. But clearly, you know, by that point, the Shah's principal strength was the military. He had, you know, he had the support of millions of people who were quiescent, staying at home. But the only strength he had in the streets, if you will, was the military. And he was unwilling to use the military in the streets, and the streets were going to become a home of the opposition.
Now, getting back to this November 9th cable that Sullivan sent out, how much significance do you think this cable had in terms of, I'll just leave it there.
It clearly had absolutely no impact whatsoever.
Yeah.
I've read the telegram many, many times since then, and it probably was too carefully crafted to make that kind of an impact. We assumed that this was the sort of opening shot of a serious reconsideration about our policy, at least a serious analysis of where we were. I'm not sure how much Bill consciously thought of it, but I'm quite sure Bill's a very, very shrewd operator, very intelligent. I think he realized that to hit Washington with a telegram that says the Shah's finished, we'd have all been called home immediately. But they'd have had the wrong effect. We sort of had to move into this by going into Cold War step by step. Of course, nobody in Washington paid any attention whatsoever to it. So we never had a chance to sort of get a reaction from Washington, then a second step on our part. And I don't know what difference it would have made, but I must admit I was shocked. I shouldn't have been. I've been dead a long time. When I came home in February, March rather, 79 for brief leave, to find out that nobody had paid really much attention to the telegram at all. And here we thought we had, and we had come in our own minds to a conclusion that the things were, that the child really was hanging on by his fingernails, and that we ought to start thinking about a future without him. The fact that nobody paid attention to it. But I think when I lectured at the Foreign Service Institute, point out that it's very difficult to get at a time of crisis to get people to pull together. Now, all these people are terribly busy. And Camp David was still very much in mind, not still going on, at least some of the ceremonies where it were, and get people to challenge a policy which had been well entrenched, you know, for many, many, many years. So it's probably foolish of us to think of that, you know, that such a process could have been undertaken.
I've read the cable myself a couple of times. I think it's, to me, it's worded a little bit indirectly in some ways. But to me, I think it shows that he's sort of concerned about keeping the armed forces intact. Mm-hmm. And that he saw a coalition between the military men and the moderate opposition as probably the best way to keep public order, assuming that the Shah wasn't going to be around. Is that sort of reasonable to think he was trying to drive towards that kind of a coalition?
I'm not sure that you'd have to ask Bill this himself.
Yeah.
We didn't have a particular firm roadmap mm-hmm. laid out, but it was clear that Washington had not yet grappled or accepted the fact that there was a possibility, a strong possibility, that the Shah might not work his way out of this.
Mm-hmm.
But therefore, we should start developing a strategy which saw that as a possibility. I think if you've read the telegram, Bill says, of course, in the interim, we have no alternative but to continue to support the Shah. Part of that is a giveaway to the strong Shah supporters in Washington, but it probably diluted the message. We were very tentative because it was perfectly clear that nobody wanted to think about it. And so we were tentative and thought we could might have a few weeks for the process to unfold.
There was no response at all? There was no phone conversation to discuss it? No cables?
Not that I recall. I don't recall one telegram from Washington. If there is, I've forgotten.
And around the same time, three State Department officials came to visit Iran. Carl Clements, George Griffin, mm-hmm. Stephen Cohen. Traveled to Iran to investigate the situation. Did you meet with them at any time during their visit?
I saw them a couple of times, of course, because George Griffin was an old friend, and Steve Cohen was an old adversary from Human Rights. And Carl Clements, I knew. I didn't know Carl that well. I met with him a couple of times, yeah.
Did they give you a sense of what the current thinking in Washington was about the situation in Iran?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
I found it very difficult because, and this is no attack on Steve Coleman, who's a very honorable and a very nice person, but he and I had been strong advocates. He had been, you know, in the forefront of the human rights people. And I had some, as director, I've had some really nasty and very difficult fights with that office, and not against Steve personally, but Steve was part of the problem, as I saw it. And so I found it very difficult to get into the kind of conversation on all three people were present. I was being very, very careful at that time. I felt it was, as DCM, I always thought, it's the ambassador's role to take the lead when it comes to questioning policy, and that I didn't want anything I said not to be in line with what the ambassador felt.
Mm-hmm.
So I must admit I was not aloof, but I did not attempt to draw the three of them as closely to me into a chit-chat as I probably should have done, but I say that had been an adversarial relationship. Sorry, I was very, very careful about that.
Did they report upon? Because I guess they traveled about Iran fairly extensively. Well, maybe not very expensive, but they traveled about.
They went around town, yeah.
And I guess other cities as well.
And Clements went off at the south, even on a consul down in Coramshaw. So he took a trip down to Coramshaw, and I forget where the others went.
Did they draw any conclusions? Did they discuss it to you before they left?
It's hard putting my mind back. I just sort of get the sense that they really was sort of where we were at that point, that the Shah was a serious problem.
Okay.
And Carl, who had previous experience in Iran, spoke good Farsi, still does, he found some of things quite strikingly different. As much of it, it wasn't a train or a plane, the guy who sat down next to see was quite willing to be really quite very outspoken about the Shah. And that was a difference with just an old ham, and that was an alarm bell going off, because when Carl had been there, nobody would have dared to do it. So it was that kind of thing that was very much of meaning to Carl. I think some of the rest of it slowly got used to it. I must remember that's the first time somewhere it must be May or June, took me aside and really tore into the Shah. I was taken aback because I felt that people, I'd always been told people were so cautious about this. I recorded that in an indirect way in a letter. But Carl got a lot of it, old friends and people. So he came back and sort of, the situation was fundamentally changed since I was here. He was the best because he had the experience, but that little things meant something to him.
That's interesting. Now, on November 11th, National Front leader Karim Sanjabi was arrested after returning from
Paris,
where he was meeting with Khomeini. And the arrest touched off more strife activity during November. Had the embassy had much contact with Sanjabi in the preceding months or around that time?
As I recall, in the Stempel or George Lambrakis, I've seen Sanjabi now and then, but I never have. As I mentioned early on in this tape, an ambassador told me that I was basically to manage the place. So I personally made no effort to meet top-level opposition leaders. If I bumped into people, that functions fine, but I thought that was the political session's job.
To what extent did the Jew or other people at the embassy believe that the National Front leadership and others in the moderate opposition as well constituted a viable alternative to the Shah?
I can't speak for other members of the embassy, but it was always one of my assumptions from the time as country director onward is that they did not have the ability to run a government. That they did not have sufficient organized support, they did not have sufficient organization, that they were seriously divided amongst themselves. And frankly, I thought of them pretty much as a feckless lot. We would probably never be able to get together to run a government. I remember as country director, every so often, I'd sit with my colleagues, a couple of them would just chat about the future. And I guess there's conclusion drawn from those days that I carried over is that while they were important, that while Mossadegh was important, and some of the individuals in the National Front were certainly esteemed gentlemen, and that they simply did not really, so I probably looked at it from a more policy point of view, it just didn't look to me like an alternative government.
Okay.
But they were the only, they were the visible opposition, and so they were the people we're trying to see.
According to Gary Sick's book, by around November, Brzezinski was concerned about Ambassador Soldan's reporting from Tehran, and there was some discussion in Washington about an alleged lack of hard political information on the country. Were there any indications from Washington that there were problems along that line, that there was some concern about inadequate information or not enough information? Did this get back to the embassy, these discussions about an alleged lack of hard information?
I don't, I don't ever recall getting a message from Washington saying, you know, could you give us more of this or that? It may have been there, and we may have responded to it, but we were not aware in November of this attitude in the National Security Council, National Security Council staff. The thing that, I suppose, had we, I don't know, you have to ask Brzezinski himself, but whether thinking the unthinkable and the continuous reporting, and there was a pile of reporting on what was going on, not just an enormous flood of stuff that went in, was just simply, he didn't like what he was hearing and would have liked us to somehow be reporting more on all the pro-Shah strength. I'm not sure, but I've seen that sort of thing in government. Why are you always reporting bad news? Well, in fact, there wasn't much good news to report. And Bill could be very sharp with his pencil, so.
Apparently, as a result of this concern about the reporting in November, Brzezinski sent, he sent the former station's chief, Arthur Callahan, to Iran as a special embassy, as a special emissary, to meet with the Shah. What did you and R. Sullivan think about this this move, sending Callahan, sending a special emissary?
Frankly, we were annoyed. It was the first sign of that somehow we weren't getting our message across. One annoyed at Art because I had known Art a long time. Bill knew him. And Art's a thorough gentleman. He and I still very well, we see each other a couple of times a year. Art had the 4 years' experience. Bill was a little concerned at the time that Art was in working for Westinghouse. And there might be that later on there could be some raising question of conflict of interest. I don't know how much Bill really believed that, or whether that was just one of his expressions of annoyance. Of having somebody come in and look over his shoulders. You know, we were annoyed at the time, not with the individual, but with the effort. And I say that was, I forget when that was, it the first week of December?
Late November, early December, I'm not sure.
But Art was a thorough gentleman. He came in and he talked with Bill, and he briefed Bill completely on what he, I've forgotten the content of all of that, but briefed Bill completely on his meeting with the Shah and his impressions. He's in the area, by the way. Yeah. If you haven't watched that.
Well, I interviewed William Layfelt, who was with GE around this time, and he was Chamber of Commerce in Tehran.
He was with General Electric.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He was also like working with a group of businessmen, Chamber of Commerce group. He noted that during the last months of '78, that members of the non-official U.S. community in Iran were somewhat irritated with the embassy because they did not think that the diplomats were sufficiently concerned about their own personal security in Iran. What was the embassy's approach to the question of evacuation of non-official Americans and their families around November, say, or
early in November? In November, we were, I suppose, basically finishing our planning on the evacuation. We started early on, and I must say, the ambassador and I were both very reluctant to get in the process of evacuation planning. We felt that that word of Americans' evacuation planning would seep into the community, seep into the Iranian community, and slowly move up to the Shah. And this, I'm talking about May, June, July, and that was not the kind of signal we wanted to send.
Try to take